As so often happens, the headline numbers got all the headlines today. But sometimes, you gotta read a little deeper. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 21st of May today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. And we begin on a Thursday. I think actually this is the 8th or 9th Thursday in a row with yet another staggering report on people filing for unemployment benefits in this economy. 2.4 million people this week, down, yes, from a week ago, but still basically the entire population of Houston, Texas. Now, what you need to know, though, is that those weekly unemployment claims come in two varieties. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going with the difference between the two and why that difference matters.
Initial jobless claims are how many new people file for unemployment benefits in a week. Continuing claims measure the total number of workers on unemployment. Erica Groshen, the former head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, says think of it like a bathtub.
The initial claims is how much water is flowing into the bathtub, and the continuing claims is how much water is in the bathtub.
Each number is important. Chris Rupke, chief financial economist at the global financial group MUFG, follows both.
Well, that's why God gave us two eyes. You have to watch both.
But Rupke says when he wants to tease out underlying trends, the continuing claims number is more important.
Because the minute the total number of people receiving unemployment starts to come down, that's the key signal that the labor market's improving.
The continuing jobless claims numbers will play a key role in whether the post-coronavirus recovery looks like a V or U, meaning the economy improves quickly, or is flatter, like an L. Dartmouth College economist Patricia Anderson will be watching that.
If the continuing claims start falling fairly rapidly, then that's good signs that we might be more U-shaped than L-shaped.
Anderson says if the continuing jobless claims just keep plodding along at about the same rate, that's not a sign that we're really turning the corner. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
An observation here as we set up this next story that a lot of the coverage of the economic fallout from this virus kind of builds on itself. Right? This is a developing story for all of us. And sometimes things happen because something else happened or there was some other story that you need to pick up on and put into the context of this whole thing, which gets me to this. Yesterday, Mitchell Hartman, did a piece for us on what tools the Federal Reserve still has available to deal with this crisis. And Congress and the White House have the full faith and credit of the United States against which to borrow the trillions of dollars all those rescue packages are going to cost. The United States can do that because it's rich. Countries that aren't rich can't. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, those countries are struggling.
You know what money does when it's in danger? It runs.
We saw a dramatic, almost an unprecedented retrenchment of capital that left emerging markets.
Andrew Caroli is professor of finance at Cornell. Investment money has been surging out of emerging markets. That's developing and middle-income countries. Caroli says in 2.5 months, four times as much money left emerging markets as it did in the Great Recession.
It's something I haven't seen in my 30 years of watching this.
Now, if you are a country, say Brazil, and people are taking their money out of you left and right, your currency is going to fall, which means it won't go as far. And that is a problem if you're in serious debt, like almost half of developing countries are.
And then this creates essentially a pandemic catch-22 for these developing countries.
Stephen Kaplan is assistant professor of political science at George Washington University.
Do you pay off the debt or do you increase your spending on all kinds of very essential items?
Essential items like fighting a pandemic. And all of this is exactly what's happening.
Pretty much every currency, every emerging market currency is down year to date.
Win Thin is global head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman.
The worst is Brazilian real, down almost 30%. South African rand down 20%. Mexican peso down about 18% year to date.
This hasn't gone unnoticed. The IMF canceled 6 months of debt payments for the 25 poorest countries. The G20 nations agreed to put debt on hold for others. Eric LeCompte says that's not enough. He's president of Jubilee USA, a group of religious organizations that promotes debt relief.
The United Nations right now predicts that 40 to 60 million people will move into extreme poverty because of this current crisis.
110 countries are asking the IMF for more loans. The UN is taking on the issue next week. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Reasonably calm at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. My boss asked me this morning what my summer vacation plans are, and honestly, as she's finding out right now, I have no idea. I mean, where are we going to go, you know? And with Memorial Day coming on Monday, a lot of people are probably dealing with a version of that same reality. Also, business trips have been canceled for going on 2.5 months now, so obviously this is a really, really bad time to be in the travel business, and it looks like it's going to be that way for a really, really long time. Glenn Fogel is the CEO of Booking.com and its accompanying brands like Kayak and Priceline and OpenTable, one of the biggest travel search engines going, in other words. Mr. Fogel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It occurred to me as I was sitting down reviewing things, getting ready for this interview, that you probably knew maybe before anybody else that the bottom was dropping out. Is my gut right on that one?
Yeah, you unfortunately, because nobody likes to be one of the people that early see what ended up being a terrible, horrific thing early, but we did see it. So we saw what was happening in China very early. And of course, we had all the hope that it would not spread, but as we all know, that is what happened.
Yeah, you have said recovery in your area, travel and related services, is going to take years, not quarters. How do you manage a company through years of incredibly fallow times?
Yeah, no, that's difficult. When you've built a company for a certain amount of volume, and now you have to adjust it to what is going to be a long, long time to come back to that volume, you have to make changes. And we've been doing that. And sadly, we've already had to let people go at our Kayak and Open Table companies. And unfortunately, you have to adjust the size of the company to match up with not only the demand you have today, but within the reasonable future. And you have to adjust.
What do you make of a lot of the forecasts, and I'm reasonably sure I've said it on this radio program myself, that there are going to be companies you wouldn't expect are going to go away, but in fact will not be around when this is over? And how worried are you about Booking.com and your other brands?
Well, there are obviously going to be significant changes to many, many companies and industries, and ours is probably, the travel industry is going to be the one that's going to be most dislocated. We, because of our size and because of being the largest player in the space and our balance sheet, will come out okay. But unfortunately, many people are going to be impacted by this. And that's why we need government to help out. We really need all the governments to step up and be a part of the solution. But we're going to need so much more to come out of this in any shape that people will be happy.
One imagines you can get various representatives and senators on the phone. Number one, have you? And number two, what has the response been when you say, listen, we need more help? Because you can read the papers. They're not doing it right now.
Well, here's the thing. People have said that this is a war. And they talk, we're fighting a war against a pandemic. And I'm like, great. I agree totally. And I say, go back to other wars. Go back to January 1942. You know, 30 days after Pearl Harbor, and where people in government saying things like, well, I'm not sure how much this aircraft carrier costs, and I'm not sure if we should, you know, build too many of those, or how much is those tanks? No, everybody said we will spend whatever it takes to win the war. So I say, if this is a war, let us all spend whatever it takes to win this war. And that war is not just coming out with a vaccine. It's winning the financial war. It's coming out so we have an economy that people can grow and develop their futures in.
You have had this disease, right? You've had COVID?
I did. My entire family back in March, and it seems so long ago. But yes, fortunately, it was very mild for us. And we were fortunate to be able to go and give blood so they can use that plasma, and hopefully it will help somebody else.
The reason I ask is because you were quoted as saying, look, I've had this thing and it was, you know, item out case, but it was terrible. And I understand why people aren't thinking about travel. And I imagine that sort of informs your approach to whatever recovery that your company is going to make.
Well, yeah, I definitely understand the fear people feel because, look, I was lucky and my family was lucky. It was mild. But I know so many people who have not been so fortunate and so many people who have suffered a great deal. And unfortunately, until we have a solution, a vaccine or a treatment that actually is effective, people are going to feel fearful and not want to get on a plane.
Glenn Fogel, he's the CEO of Booking.com. Mr. Fogel, I really appreciate your time and your thoughts, sir. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right, a couple of more stories now about some more of the changes that are coming to this economy. Item one, cosmetics. Sephora is going to start opening stores in 13 states tomorrow, stores in which the company is known for its hands-on experience. You get to try on the makeup, have your eyebrows done maybe, which presents some challenges right now, right? So Sephora's plans, which include a long list of precautions and procedures, give us a glimpse into how beauty retailers are going to adapt. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is on retail for us.
When you go to Sephora, it really is an experience. At the door, you're hit with the, some might say, overwhelming scent of perfume. Then you see the makeup testing stations with disposable cotton balls and mascara wands. You can dip your fingers in a pot of foundation. See if the color works for you.
I love Sephora.
Aaron Patterson is 35 and lives in Baltimore.
All these customer reps walking around asking you, do you need help or anything? They tell you if your skin is dry or oily, and they have recommendations for you to use as far as facial cleaners.
He's even gotten a facial at the store, one of the many services it offers. All of this is intentional. Sephora, like other retailers, has leaned into the whole experiential retail thing. Tiffany Hogan is a principal analyst at Kantar.
A store has to be just as exciting or more exciting to shop as online is easy to shop. You need to have a reason for shoppers to come to your stores. You know, instead of just selling a commoditized product as it could be viewed, you know, for beauty particularly.
So what happens now? Sephora says testers are going to be display only, and there will be no in-store makeup applications or facials, which means fewer chances to recommend products and make sales. Hogan says Sephora and other beauty retailers are going to try to fill in the gaps with things like individually wrapped samples and augmented reality. Sephora has an app that lets you see how a certain lipstick or eyeliner would look on your face.
It's surprisingly realistic. You know, even with mascara, you can tell, you know, here's the kind of volume you're going to get. Here's the length you might get.
It's not the same, but nothing is right now. And she says customers will probably come back to stores even without the hands-on experience because they're kind of stir crazy. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
As you heard from Glenn Fogel a minute ago, all that travel that we are not doing is doing some damage. Of note for us right now, the short-term rental market. Airbnb said this month it's laying off a quarter of its workforce, almost 2,000 people. Its long-awaited IPO is almost surely going to have to wait some more. Meanwhile, a new report suggests some would-be short-term hosts might be switching to longer-term seasonal rentals. Marketplace's Amy Scott does housing for us.
Kimberly Kent is an art broker, painter, and former Airbnb host in Portland, Oregon. In March, she started renting her two studio apartments to traveling nurses for 1 to 3 month stays.
We were getting about $100 a night originally with Airbnb, and what we're getting with these folks now is $1,200 a month.
That's less than half what she made when fully booked on Airbnb. It wasn't just the coronavirus. A saturated market also played a role. But as short-term bookings have dried up during the pandemic, new data from the listing site Realtor.com suggests a lot of hosts may be shifting to longer-term rentals. Tourism hotspots like Nashville, Austin, Orlando, and Las Vegas have seen the biggest increases. The company's senior economist George Ratu says for many owners facing mortgage bills,
a slightly longer term rental is a viable alternative, in a sense, to bridge the gap between the lack of demand right now and a possible rebound later.
But is there enough demand for those slightly longer-term rentals? Zillow economist Joshua Clark says a lot of renters may want more flexibility.
If I'm a renter right now and I'm seeing all the chaos going on in employment, I don't know how long this thing is going to last. I may not want to sign up for a full year at least.
And then there are all the people, especially in crowded cities, who may be looking to escape to the beach or the country. V. Nguyen is CEO of HomeAds, a marketplace for medium-term rentals. She says with many employers allowing remote work,
employees are thinking, hey, I don't actually even have to be here. I can have something a little bit more enjoyable, right?
Not to be left out, Airbnb says more of its hosts are booking longer term too and offering discounts for stays of a month or more. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Our estimate is that the sector could be worth as much as 10% of GDP.
The charity economy in the UK. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 101 points today, 0.4%, closed at 24,474. The NASDAQ dropped 90, that is 0.9%, 92.84. The S&P 500 down 23 points, 0.7%. Ended at 29.48. Best Buy saw a surge in online orders in the first quarter. What with everybody rushing out to buy home office equipment, laptops and webcams for those Zoom meetings, to gaming consoles for people looking for a break from those Zoom meetings. The company, however, is not seeing a boost from the lockdown economy. Best Buy's ticker down 4.3% on the day. Hormel, the maker of Spam and Skippy peanut butter, fell 4% today after it announced earnings that fell below expectations. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 0.67%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back in March, the state of Texas, like a lot of states, put a hold on evictions. The Texas Supreme Court, though, has ruled eviction proceedings can resume starting this coming Tuesday. As you might have heard on the program yesterday, more than 2 million Texans have filed for unemployment benefits over the past couple of months. So both tenants and landlords are paying real close attention to how this plays out. From Austin Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one.
Before COVID-19, Nastesha Ingram of San Antonio worked with folks who have Alzheimer's, but that work has dried up.
I'm paying rent right now, and the managers have been very helpful doing payment plans and stuff like that.
Ingram is in a better position than many other Texas renters. Even though she lost her job, she's still able to make rent because her husband's still working. But Heather Way, a law professor at the University of Texas at Austin, says some landlords in Texas are lining up to evict tenants for not paying.
Families around the state are really having to make hard choices between, do I pay rent? Do I put food on the table? Do I pay these healthcare bills?
And given those choices, many Texans will choose not paying rent. And if that results in eviction, that could ultimately lead to everything from damaged credit to difficulty finding another place to live to homelessness. But Fred Fuchs, a tenant advocate for Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, warns landlords to avoid a rush to evict.
If they can forbear and they are willing to be reasonable, I firmly believe they will be way ahead.
After all, he says finding new tenants isn't easy.
Who are they going to lease to in this economy right now?
Nastesha Ingram's landlord in San Antonio, Mark Hurley, wants to avoid evicting his tenants. He says it costs about $3,000 to turn around an apartment.
You evict, you have an empty apartment, you have to fix it all up, you have to market it. So we don't want to evict.
But many housing advocates worry that Hurley's in the minority among landlords. And now that the state's moratorium on evictions has been lifted, more people will be forced out of their homes. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The thing about this virus, of course, is that it doesn't care who you are or where you are or what your business is. Just like here, charities over in the UK are getting hit by this thing. Canceled fundraisers, donations down, and volunteers quarantined. There's an estimate, actually, that as many as half of British charities could go bust, which would, of course, hit not only the people they serve, but it turns out the UK economy as well. From South London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
Good morning.
Hello, is that Candice?
Hey,
hello
morning.
There. Hi.
No lockdown for Candice James and her colleagues at the Loughborough Community Centre in South London. They're running a free food delivery service for local families.
Can I just check who's on a bike today?
Kenosha's on a bike.
Miguel's on a bike. Okay, so
more than 120 local children living in poverty will get a nutritious packed lunch delivered to their doorstep today.
So you have a vegetarian option, which is mozzarella pasta.
The bright and airy community centre, set on the edge of a beautiful park, belies the bleak economics of the neighbourhood. Many of the families living here are struggling, and now so is the centre.
Many of our income strands have stopped.
Manager Candice James says that with fundraising events cancelled, the centre is reduced to living off its reserves.
They're going to run out very fast, the reserves. And then when we get to that point, we will have to reduce much of our activities.
Providing support and stimulation for local children and their families for almost 40 years, the whole centre is now at risk, she says.
I don't like to think about it, but yes, we could go under. This could be the end of Loughborough Community Centre. And I don't want COVID to be the end, but we have to face that. That could be a reality.
There are hundreds of other charities across London that are also in trouble.
Childhood Trust.
Research by the Childhood Trust, based here in the centre of the city, suggests that 40% of the charities helping children in the capital could go bust as a result of COVID-19. The Trust's chief executive, Lawrence Guinness, says these charities serve the estimated 700,000 children in London living in poverty.
Many of them will never go on a holiday, for instance. Many of them will lack basic household items, things like toothpaste, things like having enough light bulbs in the house.
So what's to be done? He says Britain's entire charitable sector will need as much as $5.5 billion to fill the gap left by the pandemic. And yet the government's only offered $900 million worth of support.
It's not enough, and what is going to be a very, very big problem.
The underfunding is not surprising, according to another charity. Pro Bono Economics donates economic expertise to good causes, and it says governments always underestimate the value of the charitable sector.
We don't do a very good job of capturing just what it is the charity sector does from an economic point of view.
Pro Bono's chief executive, Matt Whitaker, says if you take into account what volunteers save the taxpayer in salaries for social workers and the economic value of repairing damaged people, the sector is worth much more than the official estimate of $20 billion a year.
Our estimate is that the sector could be worth as much as 10% of GDP.
That's $250 billion a year.
And so if half of the charities that are out there were to go under, as some of the surveys suggest, then you're looking at a 5% GDP hit, which is, you know, under any other circumstances, that would be something that would be causing the government some sleepless nights.
The government's already having plenty of those over the vast sums the pandemic is already costing. Realistically, the charities are probably towards the back of the queue. But they say if we do go under, you'll soon find out how much we're really worth. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Mark Zuckerberg becomes the latest big tech CEO to get on the work-from-home bandwagon. Zuckerberg said today he expects half of his company's 45,000 employees to be remote in the next decade. Not just any half, though. Got to have strong performance reviews. Got to be relatively senior. And oh yeah, if you move somewhere where the cost of living is cheaper than Silicon Valley, in other words, pretty much anywhere, the company is going to localize your pay. While I've got you, by the way, there is plenty more on the business and economic news of the day, sometimes with Facebook content, most of the time, thankfully, without, in our newsletters, marketplace.org/newsletters to sign up. Here is your moment of economic context as we leave you on this Thursday. Jay Powell did an event today at which he said something that I kind of love as we all try to figure out what the heck is going to happen in this economy. Here you go.
In the best of times, predicting the path of the economy with any certainty is difficult. In fact, John Kenneth Galbraith famously said that economic forecasting exists to make astrology look respectable.
Kind of good, right? Come on. Jay Powell, kind of making fun of himself. Anyway, Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.